Chapter 13. Postlude. Does God lose interest? The classic Greek tragedies are all versions of the same tragedy. All present the human condition as a contest between the personal and the impersonal, with the impersonal inevitably victorious. If any one of the circumstances that lead so inexorably to the downfall of Oedipus in Sophocles' Oedipus Rex had been different, if, as an infant, he had been abandoned on another road than the one he was actually abandoned on, if Jocasta, his mother, had died before his return to Thebes, if any link in the chain had been broken, then his will to know the truth, his tragic flaw, would not have been his ruin. But it was foreordained that events should proceed through this and only this course, and that his end should therefore be ineluctably what it is. The spectacle is cathartic, to the extent that it succeeds in suggesting that all human lives are variations of the collision it presents. Sophocles invites us, by grieving for Oedipus, to grieve for ourselves. Hamlet is another kind of tragedy. Though we see Hamlet in a set of circumstances that involve, just as those of Oedipus Rex, veiled and revealed truth, and a tangled, passionate relationship among the protagonist and his parents, the tragic outcome never seems inevitable. Moreover, Hamlet's flaw, endlessly debated, is located somehow in his character, and so would remain a flaw in any of a variety of other circumstances. The particularity of the set of circumstances in which we see him does not play the role the comparable set plays in Greek tragedy. The contest is unlike that between doomed noble Oedipus and an iron chain of events. It is instead a conflict within Hamlet's own character between the native hue of resolution and the pale cast of thought. Centuries of commentary on these two classics will not boil down to a paragraph each, but longer exposition would not change the point to which the comparison tends. The Tanakh, however different from both, is far nearer in spirit to Hamlet than to Oedipus Rex. Its action originates within the character of its protagonist, and even when he fails to act, his failure lingers as a more important reality than any event or chain of events. No Ananke, no inexorably functioning fate, proceeding autonomously without him, ever succeeds him as the engine of the Tanakh's forward motion. Even in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where, in practical matters, the initiative passes from him to the leadership of his chosen people, that leadership understands itself to be doing his will. And whether or not their claim is persuasive, the total absence from the conclusion of the Tanakh of any impersonal alternative to the personal God is undeniable. The action right down to the last page of the collection begins either with God or with human beings. There is no third alternative, no fate, no nature, no cosmos, no ground of all being. Imagining the One God as Many. The extent to which the Tanakh is a character-dominated classic may appear to better advantage if we imagine how its action might unfold if the several personalities fused in the character of the Lord God were broken loose as separate characters. When the Lord God's character is parceled out in this way, what results is a story that immediately begins to assume the familiar contours of a more ordinary myth. Changing the names slightly, we might imagine the Tanakh unfolding more or less as follows. In the beginning, the god Elo created the physical world. Then Elo and his brother Yah set about creating the human race. Elo, calm and benign, proposed to Yah that they create mankind in our image. For Elo, the human creature was to be the crown and culmination of creation. Yah, however, was reluctant to have mankind be like one of us. He claimed the actual making for himself, and he chose to make mankind from dust, though impulsively he breathed his own spirit into his creature. Elo had sought a male and female human race from the outset. Yah, whose action always seemed to precede his understanding, at first made only the male, but gradually realized that a companion was required. Elo had proposed turning the humans loose in the whole of creation. Yah confined them instead in a garden, and imposed upon them rules intended to keep them in ignorance. The reptilian goddess, Mot, then lured the woman into disobeying Yah, and the woman in turn misled her husband into joining her in sin. Yah, enraged, humiliated Mot, requiring her henceforth to crawl, snake-like, on her belly. But the punishment he imposed on her was less severe than what he imposed on the man and woman: grievous toil, pain in childbirth, and early mortality. They were then expelled from the garden, but as they left, Yah, suddenly tender, covered their nakedness in garments of skin that he himself had made for them. Despite Yah's punishments, the first human couple was fertile, and the human race multiplied and filled the earth just as Elo had intended. But their fertility enraged Mot, who turned her sinuous and slimy body into a world-engulfing flood. All that lived, all animals and plants as well as all mankind, perished. Fortunately, Elo and Yah denied Mot a total victory. Just days before her attack, they warned Noah to build a ship and stock it with a little of everything in creation. Their battle with Mot lasted 40 days, but in the end they were victorious. The floodwaters receded and creation began anew. Elo declared that the rainbow would be an eternal sign that Mot would never again be permitted to destroy the earth by flood. Mot herself was temporarily mollified by the fragrance of Noah's burnt offering to Yah. After the lapse of many generations, in a world again filled with people, Abram, a childless, struggling nomad, received a divine visitor, the mysterious but kindly Megan. Megan promised to help Abram become a father, and to guide him to a fertile land where his offspring could become a mighty tribe. Abram followed Megan's instruction, went where he was told to go, and submitted to circumcision as a sign of his bond with Megan. Megan fostered marriages and births in Abram's tribe, assisted women as well as men, and intervened in time of famine or other threat, foiling, for example, Mot's attempt to disguise herself as Elo and demand the sacrifice of Abram's son Isaac. Megan's powers were modest, but his intentions were benignity itself. He attended quietly as Abram's tribe grew in size and prosperity. In time, Abram's tribe, now called Israel, migrated to Egypt, where it grew more numerous than the Egyptians themselves. Mot then turned the mind of Pharaoh, the king of the Egyptians, against the Israelites. Pharaoh enslaved them and began slaughtering their male infants as they were born. At length the groans of the oppressed Israelites reached the ears of Elo and Yah, and they sent the ferocious Sab to the rescue. Sab appeared to the Israelite Moses in the form of unquenchable fire and commanded him to challenge Pharaoh. There followed an orgy of violence against Egypt. Punishment was piled upon punishment. The river was poisoned, the land ravaged, and every firstborn male in the country slain. In the climax of the battle, Sab cut Mot's watery body in twain with his sword, and Pharaoh's army drowned in her remains. Israel was now free from bondage to Pharaoh, but required to serve Sab in perpetuity. Sab conducted the horde of freed slaves to the desert volcano where he made his home, and from amid smoke and flame he thundered forth the terms under which henceforth they should serve him. In fear, as much as in gratitude, they complied. He then led them back through the desert to the land to which Magan had earlier brought Abram. By sharp contrast with the unwarlike Magan, Sab commanded them to exterminate all the inhabitants of the land's central region, lest there be any temptation for them to worship another god. Initially, they carried out his instructions, but then they faltered and began to consort with the natives of the land. He had promised them wealth and power if they remained faithful to him, but warned them that hideous sufferings awaited if they were unfaithful. By degrees, alas, they did become unfaithful. After the deaths of their great kings, David and his son Solomon, Sab turned implacably against them. Using Babylon and Assyria as the tools of his wrath, he destroyed their capital, Jerusalem, expelled them from the land he had conquered for them, and sent them off into exile and slavery. Elo, Yah, Mot, and Sab then competed with one another in offering grandiose visions of what should happen next. Sab, enraged because the nations he had used as tools to punish Israel had gone too far, wanted to destroy them as he had destroyed Israel. Elo wanted to reconstruct a peaceful world order in which a splendidly rebuilt Jerusalem would be a shrine city for all nations. Yah believed that Sab had gone too far with Israel, and wanted to comfort the nation, which he suddenly claimed to love as a child or a wife. Magan was in agony. It was a cruel mystery to him how matters could have come to such a pass. He called on Yah to rescue Israel for his sake. Mot, not quite dead after all, reemerged to call for a spectacular new annihilation of the entire world. In the denouement, none of Sab's or Mot's threats was carried out. Elo prevailed on the king of Persia to permit a delegation of Jews to return to Jerusalem and build a modest temple in Elo's honor, though talk of all nations worshipping him there was quietly dropped. With Sab virtually gone from the scene, the law he had imposed was rediscovered and celebrated as the precious thoughts of a god. A brisk, practical, confident mood began to appear among the Israelites, epitomized by the brief but memorable appearances of Shira, a goddess of creativity, wisdom, and skill. At this point, as a modest but real stability was starting to take shape, Mot staged a last desperate attack. Yah, suspicious and suggestible as ever, had boasted to Mot about Job, a man exemplary both in the outward care and in the inward sincerity of his devotion to Yah. But Mot challenged Yah. Job was devoted only because Yah had treated him so well, the evil goddess claimed. Stung, Yah decided to test Job's devotion by inflicting great suffering on him. As predicted, Job persevered in his devotion. Yah gives, Yah takes away. Blessed be the name of Yah. Yah defeated Mot again as a result, but Job won a moral victory over Yah by exposing Mot's role in Yah's abuse of his servant. Yah restored Job's fortunes, but a great silence ensued. None of the gods ever spoke again, and none except Elo was ever seen again. He was glimpsed just once, as a monarch seated, white-haired and silent, on a distant throne. At length the Israelites took charge of their own lives. Elo and Yah were still honored, but their home was understood to be in heaven now. Little was expected of them on earth. The law of Sab was codified and copied, but it was now a law in firm human custody. Annually, a religious drama was celebrated recalling the epic of Israel and the gods. Its high point would come at Yah's promise to David that Solomon would be Yah's adopted son, and David's promise to Yah that Solomon would build a temple to honor all the gods and preserve the peace now achieved among them. What this polytheistic retelling of the Tanakh has that the Tanakh lacks is clarity and a sense of relative inevitability. What it lacks is a single central protagonist. Retold in this way, the course of events, playing roughly the role that the course of events would play in a well-populated Greek myth, is more important than any one actor. As each of the several gods mentioned is reduced to a signature trait or two, the narrative acquires, notwithstanding the turbulence of the action, a certain underlying calm. What will be, will be. Diffuse anxiety, by contrast, is the more characteristic mood of the Tanakh. What will be may not be. It all depends on a frighteningly unpredictable God. In this unique and endlessly influential classic, the plot is, so to speak, trapped within the principal character. Clarity disappears beneath the welter of personalities and functions that are gathered together in him. One never knows what he will do. More disturbing still, one never knows whether he will do anything at all. And events do not flow majestically and impersonally forward without him. The psalmist's cry, "Why do you sleep, O Lord?" names a religious anxiety that is also the literary suspense that pervades the Tanakh, particularly in its last third. When will the Lord God act? Or will he ever act? Massively, at the start, and residually, even at the finish, this is the all-defining question. This is the divine maw that swallows and regurgitates the tale. Creation as tragedy. But why, in fact, is this anxious interest so pervasive at the start, and why is it only residual at the end? The Lord God's life in the Tanakh begins in activity and speech, and ends in passivity and silence. That much by now is surely obvious. Not obvious is why it should be so. Why does this work take the form of a long decrescendo to silence? Why does it, so to speak, begin with its climax and decline from there? Our clue lies in the fact that the course of the Lord God's life runs not just from omnipotence to relative impotence, but also from ignorance to relative omniscience. The God we saw in the first verses of Genesis was as confident as he was active, but his confidence quickly came to seem blind, because he was so immediately surprised by the consequences of his action. Did he know what he was doing in the first place? The God we see in the last chapters of Daniel is a God who knows in stone-cold detail the entire remaining course of history. Silent as the Ancient of Days may be, he knows. As the Lord God's knowledge has grown, we must ask, what has he learned that has reduced him to silence? We may begin with his originating, implicit confession of motive. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. That line has commonly been read as a statement about the nobility of mankind, but it may also be taken as a statement about the initial untransparency of God to himself. He wants an image because he needs an image. When we asked earlier, what makes God godlike? We noted that he seems from the beginning to have no life unconnected to his human creature. Because there are no other gods, he can have no divine social life. Israelite mythology knows no Mount Olympus, no heavenly country club where a deity may disport with his own kind. True, God is spoken of almost from the start as the God of heaven. On the very first occasion when Abraham speaks of, rather than to, his God, God of heaven is the label he chooses. But the Lord God is also the God of earth. Although there is no place that is not his, there is also no place that is uniquely his. At the dedication of the temple, Solomon asks God to hear the prayers of the people from his heavenly abode. At the beginning of this long prayer, however, Solomon has said, "Even the heavens to their uttermost reaches cannot contain you, how much less this house that I have built." God is omnipresent, yes, but his omnipresence is merely another name for his solitude. There seems effectively to be nobody for him to be with but the creature he has made in his own image. Honoré de Balzac is said to have cried out on his deathbed for the characters he had created in his fiction. But what if, during his lifetime, Balzac had had no company but those characters? He would then be, analogously, in the condition in which, to all seeming, God seems to be at the start of his life. If this analogy is to work, however, we must understand a divine Balzac who is both the only writer in the world and a writer who has never written before. When he first takes pen in hand, how prepared is he for what will ensue? The Lord God, at the start of the Tanakh, is a being in whom self-ignorance is joined to immense power. Immense talent, we might risk saying, pursuing the Balzac analogy. Key among the things he does not yet know is that his ignorance of himself has something to do with his will to create. Does he create mankind because he wishes to be known, or loved, or served? In time, interaction with his creature will suggest to him that, yes, he does wish all this for himself. But at the start, he does not know what he wishes, and he does not know, either, that he needs his creature to find out. Knowledge precedes God's opening action at only one point, namely at his decision to create a self-image. Only at that point does he first say what he is going to do and then do it. Until that point, Goethe's famous line, "In the beginning was the deed," characterizes him perfectly. Only at this point does he shed the perfect but illusory confidence of a sleepwalker. And fatefully he endows his creature with the one power over which he has this modicum of conscious control. He gives the man and the woman, the couple made in his image, the power to make images of themselves. He makes them a reproducing species whose offspring will both be and not be a replication of themselves. By this inaugural action, God sets in motion the chain of actions and reactions that we have already reviewed. We return to this beginning because it brings us as close as we can come to an explanation of why God's story ends in silence. In brief, once God understands what motivated him at the start, his motivation to continue is undercut. It is this that explains why, to put it in one word, he subsides. The Tanakh as the refusal of tragedy. The desire for a self-image carries within it a tragic potential. Once you have seen yourself in your image, will you want to keep looking? Or will self-knowledge prove fatal for self-love? Will you lose interest in yourself, much less in any image of yourself, once the image has served its purpose and you know who you are? If the Tanakh were tragedy, God, having learned the truth about himself through his relationship with mankind, above all his relationship with Job, would end in despair. But the Tanakh is not tragedy, and the Lord God does not end in despair. Tragedy has clarity and finality. The refusal of tragedy typically has neither. The Tanakh refuses tragedy and ends as a result in its own kind of muddle, but its protagonist ends alive, not dead. Taken as a whole, the Tanakh is a divine comedy, but one that barely escapes tragedy. Job, by being God's most perfect image, very nearly destroys God. Job seems to offer the Lord not just blameless behavior, but also an open and adoring heart. When a round of feast days was over, Job would send word to his 7 sons and 3 daughters to sanctify themselves, and rising early in the morning, he would make burnt offerings, one for each of them. For Job thought, "Perhaps my children have sinned and blasphemed God in their thoughts." This is what Job always used to do. The Lord's fantasy was that by wantonly inflicting suffering on Job, he would provoke only a greater, more glorious demonstration of Job's adoring, selfless devotion. Job is pure and innocent. He will do anything, the Lord thinks. But to the Lord's horror, Job turns out to be a more perfect self-image of the Lord than the Lord had planned on. The Lord wants to see what Job is made of. Very well, Job will show him. But Job will also see what the Lord is made of. Job is the supreme image of God's desire to know God, for he accepts his suffering, but he does not accept it silently. He is not resigned to having no explanation for it. And once the Lord, in his climactic speech, attempts to silence Job with raw power, Job has heard as much as he needs to hear. He demands no further self-disclosure by God. In effect, he loses interest in him. Thereafter, and as a result, the Lord never regains his own interest in himself. God's exposure at the end of the book of Job ought to be the moment of truth that becomes the moment of death. Knowing himself to be what Job teaches him that he is, the Lord should find it impossible to go on. And this is almost what happens. Almost, but not quite. In the section of chapter 9 entitled Wife, we said that the feminine was not merely absent from the developed character of God, but had been actively excluded from it. At the creative start, God spoke of himself in the plural, and saw himself reflected in the human couple rather than the human male. But thereafter, the female in the divine male was suppressed, suppressed indeed far more thoroughly than the destroyer in the divine creator. When a goddess was brought into God's temple, his reaction was almost suicidally violent. For when he destroyed Jerusalem, as we have seen, he very nearly destroyed himself. Past that point, as we have also seen, the Tanakh loses its superficial narrative continuity. God's story breaks down. But narrative and character are interdependent. We may also say that past that point, God's developed character also breaks down. What rescues both God's story and God himself is what does not fit into either. In the Song of Songs, coming just after the book of Job, the non-Israelite rest of mankind re-enters the story, and a secular spirit pushes not just Israel but also God himself to the margin. The unidentified singer of the Song of Songs is a young woman of playfulness, physical exuberance, and joy. Her effect in the life of the Lord God is powerful precisely because it diffuses an otherwise fatal intensity. If the tragic climax at the end of the book of Job is not somehow trumped, God's life will be over. Song of Songs is the trump card. It breaks the mood, changes the subject, and saves the Lord's life. The Song of Songs is followed by the book of Ruth, confirming and solidifying the new mood. In that book, Naomi, not one to stand on orthodoxy, tells her 2 widowed daughters-in-law to go home to Moab, worship Chemosh, get married, be happy. But one of the 2, Ruth, insists on returning to Israel with her mother-in-law. Naomi acquiesces, but once back home, she quickly sets about the practical business of discreetly seducing a wealthy relative into marrying the young woman. Thus is the otherwise deathly silence of the Lord God covered over by the rising bustle and hum of real life. Through Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, and Daniel, the silence of God may continue, but thanks to Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Ruth, the silence merely continues. It acquires no new momentum. it does not become deafening. The relationship between God and mankind does not again reach the fatal pitch of the last chapters of the book of Job. And then, suddenly, as a motionless, long-beached boat may begin to rock back and forth again on a rising tide, we find ourselves again in a historical narrative. The Lord God has an honored place in the narrative, but He is now a motivating force rather than an actor. His precious thoughts, so cherished by the psalmist and linked by the psalmist to the Lord's still remembered and acknowledged role as the master of the physical universe, are objectified and placed in the possession of every member of the community. As their constitution, the written law to which they all swear solemn allegiance and in which some actually sign their names. Israel's immediate neighbors are hostile, but they do at least acknowledge that there is no God but the Lord God. And the king of Persia comes close to doing the same. Nehemiah, significantly, shuttles back and forth between Jerusalem and Shushan, the Persian capital. The sons of Israel in their promised land have been succeeded by world Jewry. Nehemiah may be described as, in person, the first day of the rest of the Lord God's life. Though Nehemiah is male, he has about him the energetic practicality of Lady Wisdom on creation morn. He lacks something in self-consciousness. He is inclined to act first and reflect later, if ever. He tends to recognize a sin only after he sees it committed. He becomes a warrior only when pushed to it. In all this, however, he merely recalls what his Creator was in his time of greatest vigor. Nehemiah is not divine. He is not the Son of God. But in key regards, he is the perfect reflection, the comprehensive self-image, the quasi-incarnation of the young Yahweh Elohim. Divided God, divided man. We began this postlude with the statement that the Tanakh is more like Hamlet than it is like Oedipus Rex. One might wonder why this should be. After all, the authors of the later portions of the Tanakh were chronological contemporaries of the earliest Greek tragedians. And, direct relations between the societies aside, a number of common material and social realities independently marked both. Both societies kept slaves, for example. Both grew olives. Both anointed the hair and body with oil. Both practiced animal sacrifice, and so on through a long list. Hamlet, two millennia later in a society that did none of these things, is nonetheless a closer spiritual relative to the Tanakh than to Oedipus Rex, because Elizabethan society read the Bible far more seriously than it read the Greeks, and was descended from a medieval English society that may be said, with only slight exaggeration, to have read little else. It is precisely the profound effect of the Bible on European society that explains why Shakespearean tragedy is as unlike Greek tragedy as it is. History textbooks commonly draw attention to the fact that the Bible was the popular encyclopedia of the Middle Ages. But the Bible was also a school for the medieval imagination, and within that school, the character of the Lord God was the largest, most overwhelming, least forgettable lesson. When monotheism is under discussion, the point may be legitimately made that polytheistic cultures often harbor within them an intellectual elite espousing either monotheism or some form of philosophical monism. Polytheism, in all its color and variety, according to this familiar argument, is properly to be seen as a part of popular culture. The elite know of it, to be sure, and may enjoy it and refer to it casually, but they assign it little or no intellectual importance. All this may be true, yet the historians of religion who typically make this argument tend to overlook the psychological impact of a monotheism that is imaginative as well as conceptual. A monotheism in which the divine is not just conceived but also imagined as one must have a different effect on its adherents than one in which the divine is conceived as one but imagined and portrayed in art, drama, and folklore as many. Other things being equal, protracted exposure to a god in whom several personalities coexist, and alongside whom no other god is ever portrayed, even for the folkloric fun of it, must foster a way of thinking of the self as similarly composite and similarly alone. The gods of polytheistic pantheons are not to be imagined as simple beings, to be sure. They are no monochromatic simpletons alongside the Lord God as a one-god rainbow coalition. Any one of them, Vishnu, for example, may include in his character portions of human experience, amatory experience in Vishnu's case, that the Lord God's character omits. But whatever the inner complexity of or inner conflict within a Vishnu, there is always for the devotee the possibility of imaginative as well as conceptual escape. There is always, in other words, another god to whom at will the incompatible may be transferred. It is not so for the devotee of the Lord God. Everything redounds to the Lord God's credit. Everything also redounds to his blame. He has no cosmic opponent but himself. No one can escape him, and he cannot escape himself. To the extent that the Tanakh can be called a tragedy at all, it is a tragedy, like Hamlet and explaining Hamlet, whose inevitability is this inevitability of character. The Lord God's character is contradictory, and he is trapped within its contradictions. If he were, for example, either the omnipotent Lord of Heaven, or the solicitous friend of the poor, but not both, he could escape the trap. But he is indeed both, and he cannot escape. What is a problem of theodicy for the poor man whose suffering is not alleviated? How can a good God? Is a conflict of identity for the God who does not alleviate it? Again, if he were only the tender, solicitous husband of 2 Isaiah, and not also the sword-in-hand butcher of Joshua, he could escape. But he is both, and he cannot escape. He is trapped as Hamlet is trapped, in himself. Western civilization is descended equally from Athens and Jerusalem, and we routinely speak of both kinds of tragedy. The mid-air incineration of the space shuttle Challenger, the horrifying result of a faulty O-ring, was a tragedy in the Greek manner. The torment of a man who is determined to be both a tender father to his children and a careerist athlete of the larger world is a Jewish tragedy. The first tragedy arises from without. The second arises from within. The first is swept forward to an inevitable resolution. The second can have no resolution, and for that reason may always be muddled, at worst, or trumped, at best, by some comedic intrusion. The young lovers of the Song of Songs, the cheerful schemer of the Book of Ruth, the busy builder of the Book of Nehemiah. Both kinds of tragedy are Western, but it is surely the second kind that touches us more deeply. The intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work, W.B. Yeats wrote. In its poignancy, the line seems quintessentially modern. But it has everything to do with the ancient buried memory of a god who needed to choose but could not. That god is the divided original, whose divided image we remain. His is the restless breathing we still hear in our sleep.